This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's another big summer for seductive vampires in movies, books, and television. But the creatures that really suck our blood are creatures with zero sex appeal, mosquitoes. In the U.S., mosquito bites are usually no worse than a distracting itch. But in many parts of the world, mosquitoes are very dangerous. They carry malaria, a disease that's been with us for 500,000 years and kills about 1 million people each year. How mosquitoes bite and infect humans and animals, and why malaria has been so hard to eradicate in spite of the drugs we have, are among the subjects Sonia Shah writes about in her new book, The Fever. She was first exposed to and terrified by malaria-bearing mosquitoes when she was a child visiting her grandparents in India. Sonia Shah, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, maybe other people know this, but I didn't know this until I read your book. It's not the mosquito itself that actually is responsible for the malaria. It's a parasite that the mosquito carries that actually spreads the poison, so to speak. Would you tell us about this parasite?
Well, the parasite is called Plasmodium, and it's a protozoan. It's a very wily little creature. It reproduces sexually and asexually, but all of this takes place inside the bodies of mosquitoes for half their life, and then the other half their life in whatever host they're targeting. And different malaria species target different hosts. So for us, there's at least 5 malaria parasite species, these species of Plasmodium, that actually infect humankind. And what they do is they come into our bodies in the saliva of a mosquito. They hide in our liver for a while, but what they're really after is the hemoglobin in our red blood cells. So that's what they feast upon. And then they leave to go on and infect another person. So it's this cycle of being infected by malaria parasites and having them feed on our red blood cells, the hemoglobin in our red blood cells that makes us sick from malaria.
Wait, so they leave? How do they leave your body after they've infected you?
Well, they go through several cycles of regeneration inside the human body. And so they sort of go inside the red blood cells and they chomp down all the hemoglobin and reproduce inside of there. And once they're done, they burst out. And that's actually when you start feeling sick. And they do that for several cycles. Meanwhile, some of them transform into what are called gametocytes. And these are the form of the parasite that then comes out into the bloodstream and waits for another mosquito to come along and bite that infected person and carry, and then they do another cycle of reproduction inside the mosquito and then go on to the next victim of the mosquito.
Wow, that's really horrible. So as you're suffering, you're also becoming a breeder.
Exactly. And you don't really know about that. I mean, I think that's one of the great tricks of this parasite, is that you can be infected for a week without really realizing that you're infective. So you don't feel sick the whole time you have malaria. You have the fever and chills that are the typical symptoms of malaria only occur when those parasites burst out of your red blood cells. What that does is release some of the poisons from inside, from their digestive process. And that is what, you know, you have this sort of toxic effect in the body, and that's what makes you sick. But meanwhile, the parasite has already, you know, doubled, tripled, has, you know, its numbers have become huge inside the body, and they're already creating these gametocytes that get picked up by other mosquitoes.
So what makes a mosquito a good host for this horrible parasite that causes malaria?
Well, mosquitoes and the parasite probably sort of evolved together. So the parasite itself has some vestigial machinery inside of it that suggests that it once photosynthesized. So it was probably some kind of like algae floating in the water. And so it probably partnered up with mosquitoes pretty early on, since mosquito eggs are hatched inside the water and the larvae are formed inside in bodies of water. So they probably were together for a lot longer than the parasites started infecting us. But I mean, mosquitoes take these blood meals. As we all know, the itchy bites that we get are from the female mosquito trying to suck our blood. And the reason they are taking blood is not for food for themselves, but to nourish their eggs. So that's like, that's evolutionarily speaking, such a hugely important thing to do, you know, to secure the next generation. So the mosquito actually will risk her life to get a few drops of blood to feed her eggs. Because, of course, taking that blood meal for a tiny little mosquito is incredibly dangerous. I mean, not only can they be easily swatted away and killed by the animals that they take blood from, but once they take the blood...
Like you and me.
Well, exactly. They can they get filled up with such a huge volume of blood that they can't fly, or they can't fly very well, and that is a mortal debility for a mosquito. Obviously, it needs to be able to fly to avoid predators and things. So it risks its life to do that. So that makes the parasite's exploitation of this behavior in the mosquito so wily, because the mosquito is not going to give up its blood meal. I mean, it's more important than food. It's about reproduction.
So the parasite has a pretty confirmed ride.
Exactly. So long as the mosquitoes are biting. But the trouble is, mosquitoes are very vulnerable to the environment. I mean, they're cold-blooded, obviously, and they require bodies of water that are pretty ephemeral. I mean, a lot of times mosquitoes are breeding in puddles, which can dry up. They also breed on the edges of streams or ponds and things like that. And if that water gets flushed out by rains, or if the water becomes deeper because other water's coming into it and fish can come and eat those mosquitoes. So mosquitoes are, you know, they're reliable carriers in the sense that they're always going to try their best to get that blood meal and deposit parasites in that blood meal, like, actually in the saliva that they drop into the wound when they plunge their proboscis into your skin. It's still something that is very vulnerable to the climate and to the local geography.
Are there malarial mosquitoes in the U.S. today?
There are many species of malarial mosquitoes in the U.S. today, so there's nothing
environmentally... Do I want to hear more, or should we just end the interview now?
I mean, it's amazing, really, because the environmentally speaking, there's no reason for us not to have malaria again today. I mean, we once had malaria all over this country, particularly in the South, but right up through the upper Mississippi Valley. Michigan was considered, you know, the land of ills. It was known for its chills and fever. You know, people thought at one time that the West would never be settled because there was so much malaria in the upper Mississippi Valley.
And how come there isn't that much now?
Well, there's been a number of changes. It happened pretty slowly. I mean, the sort of myth is that we developed DDT after World War II, and we blitzed millions of homes with DDT, which we did, and that ended malaria. But actually, malaria was already very much on the decline by the time DDT came online. And it had to do with agricultural changes, demographic changes, changes in settlement patterns. You know, we drained a lot of our wetlands. And, you know, today we've lost probably half of the wetlands we originally had in this country. And as we did that, of course, we destroyed a lot of mosquito habitat. We also paved over a lot of mosquito habitat. And then we also stopped living near wetlands and the shores of rivers because we stopped relying on those water bodies for our trade and our transportation. You know, we started using railroads and then roads. And so we didn't have to live so close to water bodies that made us vulnerable to mosquitoes. And we also improved our housing. I mean, I think that's a huge part of our solution to our malaria problem here in the United States, is we started screening our windows and screening our doors and, you know, having air conditioning and living indoors more.
So what are my chances of getting malaria now?
Here in Philadelphia, probably pretty slim, unless, you know, the idea is that malaria could come back to the United States, but only if our public health system really fails. So, you know, if you got malaria, I mean, you could get malaria because the malarial mosquitoes probably bite you when you're outdoors, when you have your windows open. They're around. They are biting you. And there's enough people coming over from malarious areas who carry parasites in their bodies that come into the United States. I mean, 1,000 or so Americans get sick with malaria every year in the United States. So it's not that the parasites aren't here. It's that when you get sick, if you got that sick, you would spike 103, 104 degree fever, and you would run to the hospital right away and get prompt care. And of course, we have, you know, we have treatments that work for malaria, and we've had them for hundreds of years. So it's not that we don't know how to cure the disease.
There was a period when there was an attempt to eradicate malaria by spraying with DDT, the very powerful toxic insecticide, which, you know, killed insects but also ended up being toxic to humans. Tell us first what the approach was in using the DDT.
Well, it was a pretty good plan. After mosquitoes feed on people, so they're full of blood, they need to rest almost immediately because they can't fly very well. So they rest on the nearest vertical surface that they can find, and they excrete out all of the liquid from the blood, and that makes them lighter so that they're able to fly away. So, and that takes about 45 minutes. So the idea with DDT was to spray the insides of houses, so spray all the walls of the interior of houses with a thin layer of DDT, so that when after mosquitoes took their blood meal, they'd land on this and for 45 minutes absorb all of this DDT, and that would kill them. And so in the 1950s, the U.S. State Department actually decided that they would suggest bankrolling a massive DDT blitz. This would be a global effort that would actually attempt to eradicate malaria forever. And that was the first time that we, as a species, had kind of risen up against this pathogen that had, you know, plagued us for millennia. And about 93 different countries signed on to that effort. You know, about 18 countries out of that effort actually did succeed in eradicating malaria from their borders. And most of those were islands where, you know, reinfection from other people coming in could be more easily controlled. So many other countries, you know, they got a lot of DDT, and malaria did decline for some time. But since it wasn't a perfect effort, the mosquitoes learned how to circumvent DDT. So the DDT stopped working as well. And meanwhile, people were losing their immunities to the disease. So there were a few years when many people in these countries under the DDT blitz stopped having exposure to malaria. But then as the DDT campaign fell apart, malaria came back sort of with a vengeance. And there was a massive resurgence of malaria after the DDT campaign ended in the 1960s.
So what do scientists think are the best approaches now to dealing with malarial-carrying mosquitoes?
Well, we're still doing some of the same things we did in the 1950s. I mean, we're still spraying the insides of houses with different chemicals now. We're not using DDT so much since that chemical has really fallen out of favor, although it still could be useful in some places. So we're using sprays, and we're also using bed nets that are impregnated with insecticides so that when mosquitoes try to reach somebody who's sleeping under a bed net, they actually absorb insecticide through the net, through their legs, actually, as they land on it.
The mosquitoes absorb it through their legs?
Yes, that's right. Not the people inside.
Okay.
The mosquitoes will come buzzing towards the person who's sleeping inside, and as they do, they'll land on the net. And by landing on the net, they'll absorb, a killing dose of the insecticide on the net.
Now, you write that the new global movement against malaria is led by private interests. What kind of private interests?
It's really a coalition of different actors. I mean, the WHO is part of the global campaign against malaria today, but it's really not the leader anymore. The Gates Foundation, for example, has become really the leader in setting the global health agenda because they're just such a huge, a huge contributor to a lot of these programs. So it's private philanthropists, it's WHO and organizations like the Global Fund to fight TB, malaria, and tuberculosis, and then a number of NGOs and state actors, and also corporations. I mean, companies have really stepped up their interest and their stake in fighting malaria, particularly in Africa.
Yeah, well, you're right. Oil companies have become active in the anti-malaria campaign because of their oil interests in Africa.
I mean, it's oil companies and mining companies are really, in terms of the corporate participation in the anti-malaria fight, it's probably the mining and oil companies that are really the biggest actors because they are dealing with it, you know, just in their own businesses. Because, of course, oil companies are doing a lot of work in West Africa now, and they've had to deal with awful malaria problems just in their own installations. I remember visiting, seeing Bioko Island off the coast of Equatorial Guinea, and ExxonMobil had built all of these ranch houses there for, you know, the natural gas installation they had put up there. They built all these ranch houses because they wanted all these Texas oil workers to come live there and work on it. Well, nobody came. They were all empty because people were scared of coming because of the malaria.
So we have ways of preventing and treating malaria. What are the ways?
Well, we know that by avoiding the bites of infected mosquitoes, we can avoid completely getting infected with malaria. So the trick is knowing where those mosquitoes are living and, you know, building our habitations far away enough that they don't bite us, and also protecting ourselves during the times when they bite. So these are things that entomologists have figured out in many places. You know, in some places, the malarial mosquitoes hatch from salty waters. In some places, they prefer fresh water that's sunny. Some places, they prefer streams and dark, you know, shaded waters. But these are things that can be known. And we can also know when the mosquitoes are biting. Oftentimes, they bite in the middle of the night. Some of them also bite in the evening. So we can know when to avoid the bites of mosquitoes. We also can know to recognize the symptoms of malaria and get prompt treatments, because the treatments we have, the medicines we have, actually kill the parasites in our body so that we're not infective anymore. So if we get prompt treatment, that also can start to end malaria. And of course, that is what we have done here in the United States, because we had malaria all over this country. And, you know, prompt treatment and changing the way we live actually has protected us.
Sonia, you have an interesting and kind of scary history with mosquitoes. You grew up in New England, but your grandparents were in India when you were a child, and you used to visit them every summer. And the mosquitoes were a real problem. Were you dealing with malarial mosquitoes when you visited your grandparents in India?
Almost certainly I was. I didn't know it at the time, but, you know, malaria was always this thing that everyone else in India was allowed to have and I wasn't allowed to have. So as a kid...
What do you mean by that?
Well, it had a kind of romance to it, you know. I mean, my cousins, I was the American kid, you know. I was the American Indian kid who went back, stayed with all my Indian cousins, and I really wanted to fit in. And of course, they were allowed to, you know, sleep under the stars and sleep under the ceiling fan, but I had to be enclosed in this like hot, suffocating mosquito net. It would take about 20 minutes to put it up, and you know, I just wanted to be like them. But I had to be protected from the bites of mosquitoes, and I had to take these giant horse pills that were, you know, the prophylactic medications for malaria at that time. Whereas they were allowed to have their bouts of malaria, you know, and it was just something they lived with. I mean, they considered it a normal part of life, but for me, it was very dangerous. So it was another way that I was sticking out, and the mosquitoes seemed to know it, because they really, I mean, they just attacked me and my sister. They somehow knew that we were not locals, or somehow we responded in this, you know, in this very virulent way. We'd be covered with scabs while all my cousins would just be completely smooth and, you know, unbothered by the mosquitoes.
So what does it say that you've devoted a considerable amount of time to studying malarial mosquitoes?
I think I have kind of a, I mean, most people would just have sort of a hate relationship with malaria and mosquitoes, but I kind of have a love-hate relationship, because it is something I've been so fascinated by and yet repelled. I mean, and this goes back to, you know, mosquitoes and my own family's response to insects generally. We come from the Jain religion, and you know, most people, if they hate mosquitoes, can swat them without guilt, but I can't. I mean, to this day, I feel guilty if I kill a mosquito, because in the Jain religion, you're not supposed to, I mean, you're not even supposed to walk on grass, because that could kill the little, you know, ants and microbes that are in the grass. So, you know, my grandmother used to praise people who let flies just walk all over them, because they were so nonviolent, you know, and they'd, or praise people who would take a spoonful of sugar and feed anthills. So there was this whole ethos of being kind and nonviolent, even to insects, I mean, to all creatures, but even insects, whereas, you know, all I wanted to do was slap these mosquitoes. And of course I did, and then I'd feel really guilty.
There's one more thing I want to ask you about. You mentioned that after a mosquito feeds, it's kind of too heavy to fly well, so it sits on a vertical surface like a wall for about 45 minutes and does what?
It excretes out all the liquid from the blood, so it's just keeping sort of the proteins in the blood, that and that's what it needs to nourish the eggs. So it's much lighter then, because it's not, you know, they've gotten rid of all the excess water.
Does it leave a stain on your wall when the mosquito excretes the liquids?
You can actually see them doing this. It comes out as a clear liquid, so it looks like they're urinating, basically. But you can actually see that liquid coming out. I've seen it myself. If you take the time to actually watch a mosquito that has bitten you sit on, you know, wherever it has flown to rest, you can actually see this happening.
Is that a good time to kill a mosquito because it's heavy with blood and it has to rest for a while? It's like a time out for the mosquito.
Absolutely, and they can't fly very well at that time either. So, I mean, you know, I remember when I traveling in malarious places, the walls are always speckled with smushed mosquitoes because it's just so easy to kill them when they're resting on the walls, and also you can see them better.
Of course, by that point, they've probably already bitten you, right?
That's true. They probably have already bitten you or, you know, whoever else is in your house with you.
Right. Okay. Sonia Shaw, thank you so much for sharing some of what you've learned about malaria. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Sonia Shaw is the author of The Fever, How Malaria Has Ruled Humankind for 500,000 Years. You can read an excerpt on our website, freshair.npr.org. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There was a time when movie characters often broke out into song, and those songs were written by some of the best songwriters of the 20th century, like the Gershwins, Irving Berlin, and Harold Arlen. My guest, Philip Furia, writes about songs from movie musicals, as well as theme songs from dramatic films, in his new book, The Songs of Hollywood. Furia is also the author of The Poets of Tin Pan Alley and Skylark, The Life and Times of Johnny Mercer. He's a professor in the Department of Creative Writing at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. The Songs of Hollywood is co-authored by Laurie Patterson. Let's start with one of the most famous songs from one of the most famous Hollywood musicals. Here's Gene Kelly.
I'm singing in the rain, just singing in the rain. What a glorious feeling, I'm happy again. I'm laughing at clouds so dark up above. The sun's in my heart and I'm ready for love. Let the stormy clouds chase everyone from the place. Come on with the rain, I've a smile on my face. With a happy refrain, just singing, singing in the rain.
Philip Furia, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Thank you so much.
As you point out in your book, songs for Hollywood movies have always played second fiddle to songs from Broadway musicals. Why is that?
In a Broadway musical, the songwriters were really central to the production right from the beginning. They worked with the playwright, they worked with the director, the choreographers, and they were in on where the songs were going to go in the show and who was going to do them and if new songs needed to be added. And very often on opening night, their names were on the marquee. You know, Rodgers and Hammerstein's Oklahoma or George and Ira Gershwin's Strike Up the Band. But in Hollywood, songwriters were just part of the whole production machine. They had very little say in how their songs were used. They were not brought in on conferences with the screenwriter, with the director, with the choreographer. They were just put in little bungalows and told to write songs. They really didn't have much say in how the songs were used in the films.
When you say that in movie musicals, the songwriters were told just like write songs, write hits, and that they weren't integral to the shaping of the musical the way Broadway songwriters were, that was in part because of the nature of the movie musicals. And the songs weren't integral in most of the movie musicals to the story itself. Do you want to explain?
Yeah. Historically, what happened was when they first began to present songs in movies with The Jazz Singer in 1927, starring Al Jolson, studios realized that the addition of sound made movies very realistic. You know, silent movies had transported audiences to another world where, you know, for one thing, people didn't talk out loud. But when sound came in, the movies became almost painfully realistic. And studios worried that if people suddenly burst into song the way they did in a stage musical, audiences would just find that ludicrous. So their solution to presenting a song in a movie was to make it a performance, have someone putting on a Broadway show or have somebody singing in a nightclub. Hence, the jazz singer is about a professional singer, and he sings because he's performing or rehearsing.
Yeah, there are lots of exceptions, like in a lot of the Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers movies.
Oh, yeah.
Even a song like A Fine Romance, they're sitting on a bench in the park talking about their relationship, and they break out into that song.
Yeah, well, that's what I really love about the movie musicals, the ones that don't present songs as performances, but as they are presented in a stage musical, as an expression of what a character feels, and presented as conversation, a duet between two characters that, you know, is part talk and part song. But that took a while for Hollywood to figure out. They started doing that in the early 30s, first actually with Maurice Chevalier. There was something about the fact that he was European that made it seem more realistic that he could suddenly go from talking into singing, you know, because they do that in Europe, I guess.
That's right. They're so romantic in Europe.
Yeah, they just burst into song. And so it, you know, it didn't strain the realism of the piece. But it, you're right. It's when Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers began making movies at RKO in the mid-1930s that they established the principle that ordinary characters could argue in song or, you know, romance each other in song. And audiences began to accept that convention.
Do you have a favorite Astaire Rogers example of them breaking into song naturally from the conversation?
Well, the one you mentioned, A Fine Romance, is a great example of that, where they're quarreling and the quarrel leads into a song, and a song where they don't dance, which is unusual for an Astaire Rogers musical. The music is by Jerome Kern, and has a wonderful lyric by Dorothy Fields, where she has clever rhymes, fellow and jello. And we should be like a couple of hot tomatoes, but you're as cold as yesterday's mashed potatoes. Just a delightful lyric.
Well, why don't we hear it?
A fine romance with no kisses. A fine romance, my friend. This is, we should be like a couple of hot tomatoes. But you're as cold as yesterday's mashed potatoes. A fine romance, you won't nestle. A fine romance, you won't wrestle. I've never mussed the crease in your blue serge pants. I never had the chance. This is a fine romance. A fine romance, my good fellow, you take romance, I'll take jello. You're calmer than the seals in the Arctic Ocean. At least they flap their fins to express emotion. A fine romance with no quarrels, with no insults. All the morals, you're just as hard to land as the Ile de France. I never get the chance. This is a fine romance.
So that's Ginger Rogers from the movie Swing Time. My guest is Philip Furia, and his new book is called The Songs of Hollywood. The kind of singing in movies was different from the kind of singing on Broadway before Broadway singers could mic themselves. Like now on Broadway, you can sing in a small voice because you're mic'd. You couldn't do that until relatively recently. Broadway singers were not mic'd. So what was the difference between how film singers could sing and Broadway singers, and how did that change the kind of songs that were written for movie musicals?
Well, Gene Kelly once said that he had an advantage over people who could really sing because he could talk his way through a song. And that really became the style in the 1930s, where you have someone who's not really a professional singer like Fred Astaire kind of chatting his way through a song. And the fact that they had developed this system of pre-recording and playback, where they would record the songs in the studio singing into a microphone. So the song could be much more intimate and casual, much more conversational. And then when they did the song on the set, they would lip sync to a playback of the recording they'd done in the studio. So we can see all those singers in the 1930s and 1940s. I always think of Donald O'Connor in Singing in the Rain, where he doesn't make them laugh and he's bouncing all over the room. He's lip-syncing to his own pre-recorded performance so that they could make the song seem even more casual, more nonchalant. And that established a style of presenting song in film where it's almost as if the characters are talking to each other.
You know, in talking about that style of casual talk singing, one of my favorite examples of that, which I know from your book is one of your favorite examples of that, is Bob Hope and Shirley Rost from the big broadcast of 1938 singing Thanks for the Memory.
Oh, yes, I love that scene and that song.
And I'd like you to talk about what makes this song so special.
Well, the song is by, again, it's Hollywood songwriters that most people probably have never heard of. Leo Robin was the lyricist, and Ralph Ranger was the composer. And the producer came to them and said, you know, we've got this new star, Bob Hope, and he's going to be in a movie, and it's going to be a song about divorce. Well, 1938, you know, divorce is still a pretty touchy subject. And they said, the producer said to the songwriters, write a song about a divorced couple that still is in love with each other but can't really acknowledge the fact that they're still in love. And they're going to be on an ocean liner sitting at a bar, and they're going to sing to each other. But Hope is a comedian, so make sure the song is funny too. So you can imagine these poor songwriters, you know, write a funny song about divorce. And they came up with this delightful, it would be called in the 1930s, a list song or a catalog song, which consists of, you know, one image, one allusion after another in a great big long list of images. The song is done with Hope and Shirley Ross sitting at a bar, and they part talk it and they part sing it as they go through the memories of the days when they were married. And the song is witty and clever, and yet underneath it, Leo Robin, the lyricist, manages to suggest that these are two very sophisticated people whose veneer of sophistication won't let them show their real feelings until the very end when Shirley Ross breaks down in tears and runs off. So it's a very moving performance, and again, very much in the Hollywood style of a conversational kind of song.
Yeah, they talk and sing this. Yeah, I love this. So let's hear Thanks from the Memory. This is Great. Bob Hope and Shirley Ross.
So thanks for the memory of crap games on the floor.
Nights in Singapore. You might have been a headache, but you never were a bore.
I thank you so much.
Thanks for the memory of China's funny walls, transatlantic calls.
That weekend at Niagara when we hardly saw the falls.
How lovely that was.
Thank you.
Thanks for the memory of lunch from 12 to 4, sunburn at the shore, that pair of gay pajamas that you bought and never wore.
Say, by the way, what did happen to those pajamas? Huh?
Letters with sweet little secrets that couldn't be put in a day wire.
Too bad it all had to go haywire. That's life, I guess. I love your dress.
Do you?
It's pretty.
Thanks for the memory of faults that you forgave. Rainbows on a wave.
And stockings in the basin when a fellow needs a shave. I thank you so much.
Thanks for the memory.
That's Bob Hope and Shirley Ross singing Thanks for the Memory from the big broadcast of 1938. My guest is Philip Furia, co-author of the new book, The Songs of Hollywood. That song became Bob Hope's theme song.
Yes. Most people misquote the title. They call it Thanks for the Memories, but it's Thanks for the Memory. But yeah, always associated with him, but very few people, I think, have seen the movie.
So sometimes songs were worked into dramatic films. Films that weren't musicals. And was that sometimes because the studio owned the rights to the song?
Oh,
wanted
yes.
to make money from it?
Oh, yes. When sound movies came out in the late 1920s, a lot of the studios, particularly Warner Brothers, bought up the old sheet music publishing firms that used to be known as Tin Pan Alley.
Oh.
Because they wanted that catalog of songs. They figured songs that have proven their popularity, that they would own these songs and they would stick them in a movie. Probably the most famous example of that is Warner Brothers stuck the song As Time Goes By, which was written way back in 1931, into the 1942 movie Casablanca. One guy who loved the song when it came out in the 1930s was the author of a play called They All Come to Rick's, which was the basis of Casablanca. And he had used the song in the play. So when Warner Brothers took the play, they thought, well, they're already using that song As Time Goes By, and hey, we own the song. And they thought, well, that was a popular song. We'll make it popular again and sell some sheet music and some records of As Time Goes By, and the song will help popularize the movie. Nobody thought the song was very good when they made Casablanca. In fact, the guy who scored the movie thought it was terrible, and he said, I can write a better song than that, and actually wrote one, and they were going to refilm the scene with Ingrid Bergman and Dooley Wilson, who played the piano and sang it. But Ingrid Bergman had already cut her hair off to play Maria in For Whom the Bell Tolls. So the song was saved by a haircut, and it turned out to be enormously popular all over again.
So why don't we hear the song performed by Dooley Wilson?
Wonderful.
Play it once, Sam, for all time's sake.
I don't know what you mean, Miss Elsa.
Play it, Sam. Play as time goes by.
Oh, I can't remember it, Miss Elsa. I'm a little rusty on it.
I'll hum it for you. Sing it, Sam.
You must remember this. A kiss is just a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by. And when two lovers woo, they still say I love you.
That's Dooley Wilson singing and playing piano from the movie Casablanca. My guest is Philip Furio, author of the new book, The Songs of Hollywood. There's a great example of a Hollywood studio working a song into a movie because they owned the rights to it, and a movie that is so not a musical. I'm thinking of Key Largo.
And oh, wonderful scene, yeah.
Tell us the story behind the song in that movie. I mean, this is a movie where people are basically held hostage on an island during a storm.
Yeah, a wonderful use of a song in a dramatic film is in the movie Key Largo, where Claire Trevor sings the song Moanin' Low. She's the moll, the girlfriend of Edward G. Robinson, who, as always, plays, you know, a notorious criminal. And she's also become an alcoholic, and she's begging him for a drink in the bar in Key Largo as he is holding Humphrey Bogart and Lorraine Bacall and other people hostage under gunpoint, he and his henchmen. And he says, you can have a drink if you sing that song you used to sing when you were on Broadway. And she says, do I have to sing it without accompaniment? And he said, yeah, just get up and sing. So she starts singing Moanin' Low. And it's a wonderful song about a woman who's trapped in a relationship with a very cruel man. And as she's singing it, performing the song, you see her realize that that's exactly her real life situation, that she's trapped in a relationship with Edward G. Robinson. And that realization has her slowly break down, and her voice falters, and she sings off key. And after she finishes, she asks for the drink, and Robinson says, you are lousy, and he won't give her one. And Bogart walks over under gunpoint, goes over to the bar, pours her a stiff drink, walks it over and gives it to her, says, you deserve this. So it's just a great dramatic scene, but it's a wonderful use of a song in a non-musical picture. She won a Best Supporting Actress Award based purely, I think, on that performance of a song.
So let's hear that scene with the song from the movie Key Largo.
My gowns were gorgeous.
always look a very décolleté. I wore hardly any makeup. Just some lipsticks, that's all. No lights. Just a baby spot. I wouldn't have any entrance. They'd play the intro in the dark and a spot would come on. And there I'd be.
Well, go ahead, sing.
Moaning low, my sweet man, I love him so. Though he's mean as can be, he's the kind of man, he's the kind of woman like me. Gonna die if sweet man should pass me by. If I die, where'll he be? He's the kind of man needs the kind of woman like me. Don't know any reason why he treats me so poorly.
That's Claire Trevor singing Moaning Low from the movie Key Largo. My guest, Philip Furia, is the co-author of the book The Songs of Hollywood. Now, although a lot of Hollywood songs are written differently than Broadway songs, and although the role of the Hollywood songwriter was different than the Broadway songwriter, at some point a lot of Broadway musicals were adapted for the screen. And so the Broadway musical became transposed for movies. What do you think worked and what didn't work? Like in the 50s that this phenomenon really bloomed.
Right. In the 1950s, television moved into the American home, and it really took business away from Hollywood. And studios had to cut back on the number of movies they made, and the most expensive kind of movie to make is the musical, where you have to have dancers, musicians, songwriters, choreographers. And so Hollywood, when they made a musical, took the safe route of making a film version of a Broadway musical that had already proven successful, rather than do what they'd done in the 30s and 40s, and that is make original film musicals like 42nd Street and Meet Me in St. Louis. Those are originally done as Hollywood movies. But things like Oklahoma and The King and I and South Pacific were just film adaptations of Broadway shows. And I frankly find most of them pretty boring.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that.
Oh, good. I don't know. Most people adore them and get very irritated when I say that because I say, you know, I'm writing about movie musicals, and they say, oh, I love West Side Story. And I said, well, that's not a movie musical. That's a Broadway musical that was turned into a movie. And usually when that happens, you get the worst of both worlds.
Well, I love West Side Story, so I love the movie adaptation of it, so I'm going to leave that one out of.
But, okay.
But a lot of the Rodgers and Hammerstein adaptations, like the songs just schlep on, and there's so much talking
right
in between. And
They're very stagey. I mean, these were successful stage musicals. What makes it even worse sometimes is that some of them are dubbed, you know, like Audrey Hepburn, poor Audrey Hepburn in My Fair Lady. You know, she's so sweet and fragile looking, and yet she's dubbed by this operatic singer, Marnie Nixon. And so out of little Audrey Hepburn comes this booming voice. But the fact that people love them, I think, is a tribute to how great the stage musical was, that even in a canned film version, it can still move audiences.
Well, you know, you mentioned Audrey Hepburn being dubbed by Marnie Nixon for My Fair Lady. In the film Funny Face, in which she co-starred with Fred Astaire in 1957, she sings for herself, and she has such a lovely voice. Well, why don't we end by hearing that for people who haven't heard Audrey Hepburn sing in her own voice, although probably a lot of people heard her sing a little bit in Breakfast at Tiffany's. So this is her singing the Gershwin song, How Long Has This Been Going On? Do you like this version of it?
Oh, yes. I love it. Again, you're talking about a song in a movie that's presented more conversationally, and like Gene Kelly and Fred Astaire, not by someone who's a professional stage singer, but an ordinary person just breaking into song.
Philip Furia, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Philip Furia is the co-author of The Songs of Hollywood.
I must find why my mind is behaving like a dancer.
What's the clue to pursue? For I have to have the answer. I could cry salty tears. Where have I been all these years? Is it fun? Or should I run? How long has this been going on?
You can read an excerpt of Philip Furia's book, The Songs of Hollywood, on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also download podcasts of our show. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Henry Baldonado, Joan Tui Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, and Lauren Krenzel. I'm Terry Gross.
Oh, I feel that I could melt into heaven. I'm hurled. I know how Columbus felt finding another world. Can I trust how I feel? Is this my Achilles heel? Look at me, I'm all at sea.